Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. This weekend, we've got you covered from comedy and jazz to the best of Bach. We kick things off with the Magnolia Baroque Festival's Glenn Siebert. He's got a white powdered wig, a trilo, a song in his heart, and he's eager to share his passion for early music with you. Sarah Barnhart and J.J. Johnson are here for a few good laughs and then some with their comedy Potluck. And bassist Matt Kendrick is here to keep jazz alive. He'll be swinging us through the best open mic jam sessions in the Triad. After the break, we take a ride on the conductor's podium with one of the greats, and then we get up close and personal with a theorbo. The Your Who is coming up next on Triad Arts Weekend. The biennial Magnolia Baroque Festival is Bach and badder than ever, with world-renowned early music soloists and an entire week of fascinating programs from Friday, May 25th through the 31st in Winston-Salem. Magnolia Baroque Festival's fifth anniversary season is a unique opportunity for Triad audiences to hear gifted musicians from all over the world performing a remarkable series of concerts from the best of Bach's gorgeous cantatas to an entire evening of sundry ground bass classics. What's a ground bass, you ask? Well, Magnolia Festival founder, director, and accomplished tenor Glenn Siebert is here to explain that and much more. You'll find the complete performance calendar and ticket information on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. We can go right into divas. How's that? How's
okay. That transition? I know that's maybe a little unfair, but diva for the two performers, it's Ingrid Matthews and Julie Andreski, who have both been with the festival for multiple years. Julie is the music director of the Atlanta Baroque Orchestra, and Ingrid is the music director for the Seattle Baroque Orchestra and is actually a native of Winston-Salem. Her father, Clifton Matthews, was on the faculty at UNCSA for many years as a piano professor. And they're both the very top players in their field. So I thought, well, we got both of them. Why don't we just have both of them have a solo concert? And the big idea is just to have those two divas, as in goddesses, play a virtuosic concert and leave it up to them to work out what they're going to play. They'll probably play some duets, and it'll be fantastic, no doubt. My management style of this festival is to take advantage of the brilliant players we have and give some parameters on what the concerts are going to be and let them loose and let them be creative. They feel like they're invested in it. They can try new pieces. They can pull out pieces that they've done before. I might suggest one or two pieces that personally I think would work well for an audience or I would just like to hear. So leaving it up to them creates that quality of investment for them, and it does translate to an audience.
On Saturday, then, May 26th, following the Divas concert, it's ground.
Yeah, this is going to be a great concert, partly because this is my idea, and everyone in the festival is involved with this. So we've got our string players, we have bass, we have theorbo, we have organ, we have harpsichord, we've got oboe, we have French music, Italian music, Spanish music, English music, and all different styles, but all based on that ground bass idea. Very dancey. As a matter of fact, we're going to have a dance. We're going to do the Corelli Follia, which is a very famous piece. It means fool. And so those feet are going to be dancing. Early stuff, Monteverdi, Weichlein, and then later Handel pieces as well. We're thinking about doing the Pachelbel Canon in D just to have that as a point of reference.
So chaconnes and passacaglias abound on the ground concert Saturday, May 26th. And then we're on to Plucked. Mm-hmm. Joe Gasho on that performance and John Lenti. So we got a first prize winner in the 2002 Jurau International Harpsichord Competition from Joe. And John, no slouch, Baroque Quartet recently awarded the Early Music America Naxos Recording Prize and a theorbo player, lutenist.
Yeah, he's also going to bring his Baroque guitar with him. And it's called Plucked, and Joe wanted to call it Pluck You. But that didn't go in there.
Not on NPR. It's
no,
not going
okay.
To,
no. Well, so it's called Plucked because the harpsichord is a plucked instrument.
That's right.
It's not a hammered instrument like a piano. Hmm. So the hammers don't strike the strings. Their mechanism for a harpsichord has a little plectrum that plucks. And so, you know, it's a plucker. And so plucked is about instruments that are plucked, and that would be the harpsichord, the theorbo, the lute, the guitar. And those two guys are going to rock and roll.
You've just thrown off that term theorbo like it's in every rock and roll band today.
And sure.
Don't see a lot of those floating around these days. Beautiful instrument.
It is a gorgeous instrument. And John Lenti, who is the theorbo player, calls it a lute on steroids. So it's really two instruments in one. It is a bass type instrument, so it has a very long neck and strings that sound bass notes. And then next to it, it has a lute-like string structure. So you can play bass and chords at the same time. So oftentimes it's used not necessarily as a solo instrument, but as a continual instrument, and that's like a keyboard instrument to have harmony supporting singers or instruments.
So we get a little plucked, you get some ground, you get some divas, and then coming up on Tuesday, May 29th, it's time to dance. The people in the audience get to bring their cha-cha
heels. That's right.
Heels.
This is at Cranky's, and hopefully everyone who comes to this concert needs to know that they are going to be dancing. It's contra dances, and you know, in town, in Winston-Salem, there are regular contra dance venues where people dance, and it's the same type of idea. So it's music to be danced to, contra dances, 18th, 17th century mountain music.
Johann Sebastian Bach in his white wig and staring solemnly at the portrait artist, but these folks, even Bach, loved to get up and shake his booty. They loved to dance.
Oh, sure. I mean, he was, you know, the music director of a coffee house. So it would add regular coffee house concerts where people would just sit around and listen to tunes. And that's why we're doing it at Cranky's, because it's got that kind of history behind it.
Bach the Beatnik.
Well, you know, he was a busy guy.
He was a busy guy.
He wrote, you know, over 1,000 compositions, and, you know, he had 20 kids, so he was a busy guy.
From contra dance and coffee, we grab the coattails of the big man himself, and it's time for Bach cantatas.
Yes, and that's just a whole different thing.
Yeah.
So we're going to do two whole cantatas from Bach's Weimar period. He worked in Weimar when he was a young, fairly young man in his 20s before he took his big job in Leipzig. And it's one of those things where you have a young man who is given an opportunity to write something creative and he just goes all out. These two particular cantatas are very different, but they were written right next to one another when he was in Weimar and are exuberant and beautiful. We're going to do it at Home Moravian Church in Old Salem, which is a gorgeous setting.
And you can hear this gorgeous Bach cantata live in concert Wednesday night, May 30th at 7:30 at the Home Moravian Church in Old Salem. My thanks to Magnolia Baroque Festival founder, director Glenn Siebert. Magnolia Baroque celebrates its fifth anniversary season beginning Friday, May 25th at 7:30 in Watson Hall on the University of North Carolina School of the Arts campus with two brilliant violinists, Ingrid Matthews and Julie Andrzejewski, performing music for solo violin and continuo. Two great divas in concert. The festival runs through the 31st with new venues like Home Moravian Church in Old Salem and Cranky's Coffee downtown. You'll find links to the complete calendar of events, along with ticket information and more, on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. And coming up in the second half of the show, our good friend, tenor Glenn Siebert, will sing us a 17th century Italian love song that'll tear your heart out live from Studio A. I hope you'll stay with us for that. But in the meantime, welcome to the Jazz Lounge with the Triad Treasure. For decades, the Piedmont Triad enjoyed a thriving jazz scene well into the 90s, when it wasn't that hard to find a jazz club or an open mic jam session in progress on any given night. Those heydays may have come and gone, but my guest today, one of the region's finest jazz musicians, composer double bassist Matt Kendrick, is doing his darndest to bring him back. You can hear Matt swinging Tuesday nights from 8 to 11 with drummer John Wilson and keyboardist Ken Rhodes at Tate's Bar on 4th Street in downtown Winston-Salem. It's open mic night every Tuesday night at Tate's, and you'll find links to more information at wfdd.org/triadarts.
always liked to listen to music. And then my grandfather gave us a bunch of records, and he had this one thing he could play on piano that was kind of like this little boogie thing. But we'd play it again, Papa, da-da-da-da-da-da, and he'd play it. But he had some Benny Goodman records and some Teddy Wilson. I remember the first time I think I heard a trio of Teddy Wilson playing.
Teddy Wilson, great pianist, and Benny Goodman, great clarinet player.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But hearing Teddy Wilson play like jazz piano for the first time was kind of like, you know, I just remember hearing that and going, golly, listen to that. I never heard anything like that, you know, and because, you know, he was an accomplished, he could do it, man. I started playing bass around 14, had a guitar and stuff before that, and went to a band rehearsal and started playing bass. And
electric at that point or upright?
Electric. Yeah, the bass player wanted to sing, so I got to play bass. And I could do it and fell in love with it instantly. And so I saved my $35 and went and got some crappy bass down at the pawn shop and learned how to play it. But then played in, you know, like rock bands and a lot of improvisational rock music. We played a lot of Allman Brothers and Cream, and you know, where you improv a lot, you know, there's a lot of jamming going on. And then I heard Weather Report one night late. I heard
Jaco Pastorius?
No, it was pre-Jaco. It was Mysterious Traveler with Alfonso Johnson on bass.
Alfonso Johnson.
Yeah, I just heard that and I was like, wow, what is that? The weirdest thing is I had this record by Dave Holland called Conference of the Birds.
Dave Holland, another great bass player with Keith Jarrett and other players.
Yeah, he played with everybody, Miles. But this particular record had Sam Rivers on alto sax and Anthony Braxton on sax and drummer Barry Outshaw. And it was called Conference of the Birds, a very avant-garde record that I picked up at Zayre's. I like the cover. That looks cool. I think I'll buy it. Back when they had albums, and I put on this weird record, listened to it, and I didn't know what in the world I was listening to. It was like kind of Ornette plus, you know. It was Ornette Coleman, who was a modern jazz innovator of the avant-garde, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
So I sort of backed into it, and then I got into fusion because I was playing in this big funk band. We played like a lot of Mandrill and OJs and Parliament, where we'd have like these long extended funk jams while the people would dance for 20 minutes, and when they quit dancing we'd stop and play another tune. That was the general concept. And damn, it was called Tragedy AD.
So from that was an interesting little travel we just had there, man, because you went from Teddy Wilson and Benny Goodman, then you went to avant-garde, and then now we're going back to fusion funk.
Yeah.
And then from there you got an upright at that point?
It was just all over the place through high school. You know, I was just music, and I knew I wanted to be a bass player. I didn't know how it worked or whatever, but I just wanted to do it. So then, high school ended, and I had to do something. So I went down to the School of the Arts. They needed bass players. So I go down there and auditioned for Lynn Peters.
An upright bass?
Yeah, well, I go down with my electric bass.
Oh, okay. And this is in front of she was a principal bass player in the Winston-Salem Symphony at that point?
Yeah. Yeah, she played with Detroit Symphony and a bunch of other stuff.
The real deal.
Yeah, Lynn. And she took me on, and I practiced, man, you know, 4, 5, 6 hours a day. Wow. Like a fiend, you know, just to get that big monster happening. And the next year, I got thrown in the orchestra. So there I am, after playing the bass for a year, I'm playing Brahms' Requiem.
Wow.
I think it developed some sort of inferiority complex. Yeah.
Well, that's a big meaty part for the bass.
God.
My word. So what was that transition like for you then? I mean, you really threw yourself into it, but just going from electric to upright bass. I mean, you got to really have some strength in those fingers for that upright, don't you?
Yeah. Well, I didn't know. I was 18. I was stupid. It was big. Okay. And I just started playing it over and over. You know, I had this bow, and I just played it all the time. And whatever she told me to do, I just did it. About 2 years ago, I decided, okay, this town has got to get something going on. There was very little going on jazz-wise. There was no open mic night, no gathering or focal point or anything. So I said to myself, it's time you're going to have to go do this again. Because it's a lot of work, you know. And so I went down to the old Winston Club and looked at that. I said, well, maybe. And I went down to Tate's and sat down, had a drink set at the bar. There's a friend of mine there. She said, let me introduce you to this guy. And John was there, John Tate, and I talked to him for a little while. And said, well, you know, I'm thinking about this open mic thing. And they had just opened, and they were like, you know, just smoking. You know, it was this crowded because it was the hottest new place. And he said, well, let's try it. So, you know, and I explained. I said, it's a commitment, man, you know, because we can make this like an institution. It'll become a thing. People know where it is. And it's part of the fabric of the community. It's, you know, it's a commitment. And he understood that and embraced it. And he's been very supportive of it. And so we've been down there for 2 years doing open mic night. And the cats come down. they hang out and they play and they, you know, people get to interact with each other. And since we started that gig a couple of years ago, there's a couple more gigs downtown. The Crankies has one on Mondays.
Open mic night?
Yeah, it's like a 7:30. It's more like a sort of a rock jazz thing. It's with Daniel Seraf has that going on. And we're on Tuesdays from 8 to 11 at Tate's. And then on Wednesdays, they have one at Encore, which is beside the Stevens Center.
Hmm.
And that's 8 to 11. And then on Sundays, there's live jazz at Milner's. Charlie Colbert does that, and he's been up there for years now.
Well, so describe the scene for me, because these open mic things, jam sessions, you just put me in the audience, and what am I going to see?
Well, if you come down to Tate's on a Tuesday, the first set, usually it's me and Ken Rhodes and John Wilson. We'll play some tunes.
Ken Rhodes, pianist, yeah. And John Wilson, drummer.
Right. And we'll be playing standard swinging jazz tunes. They have a piano down there, a real piano, and I'm playing acoustic bass, and it's pretty swinging. And then some guys will filter in, some of the saxophone players, and they'll get a drink, and they'll eventually, when they want to feel like playing, they'll come up and start playing, and a singer or two might come by. And by the end of the night, you might be hearing, like this the other night, we had Cameron McManus on trombone and Chick Freeman, this guy from San Francisco, he plays alto and Burns. He moved back here just because they wanted to get out of there. And he comes in, and God, it's like amazing. And Matt Cosma comes and plays his tenor, and Josh Tillman will come by with his trumpet, and we have some really good singers that come through there. And it's just really something. Sometimes it's amazing, you know, I mean.
You never know what you're going to see. That's the beauty of those sorts of open mic setups. I mean, it just depends on who's in the audience on that day.
Yeah, well, we had one at the Speakeasy, I was going to say. I did that one for years. I don't know if as long as they were open.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Speakeasy had, we did it on Wednesday there. That was after Leon's in Speakeasy and now Tate's. So it's kind of like an institution. And there's more people doing it downtown. And because it was successful, I think it helped get some other clubs going downtown. And so things are definitely picking up around here.
That's composer, double bassist, and Wake Forest University Music Department faculty Matt Kendrick. He's spreading the jazz gospel and walking it like he talks it at Tate's Bar in downtown Winston-Salem. Tuesday night is open mic night at Tate's with Matt on bass, keyboardist wizard Ken Rhodes, and drummer extraordinaire John Wilson. That's every Tuesday night beginning at 8 at Tate's Bar, 279 West 4th Street in downtown Winston-Salem. You're listening to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Do you ever wonder what it'd be like to be up on stage in front of a room full of strangers who all paid money to have you make them laugh? Well, after this short break, we'll get inside the mind of the comedian and comedienne with Comedy Potluck's J.J. Johnson and Sarah Barnhart. Make them laugh next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Let's face it, life is good, but life can be tough, too. And couldn't we all use a good laugh right about now? Well, comedians Sarah Barnhart and J.J. Johnson certainly think so, and they're more than happy to accommodate you at the Comedy Potluck every second Tuesday and fourth Saturday of the month at the Community Arts Cafe Underground Theater in Winston-Salem. The bi-monthly show features local stand-up comedians and Winston-Salem's own improv troupe, Naked Feet. The next show is Saturday, May 26th at 8 o'clock, and you'll find links to more information at wfdd.org/triadarts. J.J. grew up in Winston-Salem and eventually wound up in L.A., where he worked on films like Malibu's Most Wanted and Charlie's Angels 2. You may recognize the actor-comedian as one of the on-field entertainment hosts for the Winston-Salem Dash, where J.J. tag teams with his colleague Sarah Barnhart to keep the crowd on its feet. Sarah is a Winston-Salem native, comedian, actress, and owner of the Dueling Butter Knives, a website devoted to sketch comedy and comedic marketing. Sarah, I guess, given that you were kind of shy, what drew you to theater to begin with? I mean, you were a screwball at home, right? I mean, you made your family laugh.
Right. And I loved going to shows. And I remember being in the audience as a kid being like, I want to do that one day. And I didn't think I actually would. But then I got involved in high school and I was hooked.
What was that first experience like, I mean, being up on stage and doing it?
Pretty fantastic, actually. It was my junior year of high school. We did Cinderella and I was one of the stepsisters. And so we put a very comedic spin on those. And it was awesome just to make a bunch of people laugh by doing these crazy things that I would only do at home normally, but now I brought them out in public and it was okay.
Yeah. Nice to work when you can get it.
It's good to, before I get on stage, just sit there and just kind of relax and be this reserved guy, which I'm thinking that's usually me, but I think it to the audience it can be pretty cool to see this guy over here kind of laid back. And then he gets on stage and just bop, and he turns it on. Everything I say in my mind I commit to. That's what makes it not about what I say, but how I say it.
Give me an example. You have to turn it on, but how much of that is needed to do your job? I mean, you're a room full of people that don't know you. I mean, that you got
to
be...
Well, it's like I go on stage as if to say, everything I say is funny. You guys are going to believe it. This is funny. I like this, and I completely commit to it because I'm funny. And that's in my mind. That's what's going on with my words coming out, with my jokes. And that's what you got to do. And I think for people to sit there and look at that, it's like, even if they're not laughing, they're being entertained because it's like, wow, this guy believes all this. And nobody wants to see anybody that's not sure.
Sometimes I wonder whether it's more painful for the person on stage who bombs or the person in the audience who just sits there and as I do, and cringes and tries to empathize and go through this whole distorted thing. But you've probably seen it from both ends. Better to be in the audience or up on stage?
I think I agree with you, actually. It is harder to be in the audience watching it in situations like that.
You're helpless. There's nothing you can't throw them a joke.
Right.
But Sarah, tell me about that whole dynamic, because I mean, you alluded to it there, JJ. You're getting up on stage in front of a room full of people who want to laugh. They don't know you from Adam or Eve, and it's go time. It's a lot of responsibility. How do you deal with that?
It is. And every time I do it, I'm like, why do I do this to myself? I chose to do this. I don't have to do this right now, but I'm doing this. And whenever I am preparing for a show, I always imagine a room full of people just staring at me, not laughing at all. I don't know why, but that's the image that I get.
And while you're on stage, you're thinking that?
No, before the show.
Oh,
or
okay.
Like if I'm preparing for it the day before or something like that,
yeah.
Or the week before. It can be very scary, and it's been that way from the beginning, and I don't think that's ever going to change. Maybe it will, but I guess my image of a room full of people not laughing, if I can have that image and then I go and I get a few people to laugh, it's better than the previous imagination.
That's great.
I get people ask me, are you nervous? Are you scared? You know, right before I go on. And it's like, not really then, but like you were saying, like before, when I'm sitting thinking about my material and I'm writing and looking at it, I'm thinking, man, I got on Friday, I have to go into this room with these people and make them laugh. That is strange. And I think about that and think about it, and it doesn't begin to make sense until right before I perform. It's like, I've never played in the NFL, but if I did, I imagine
I have.
Those. You have, Sarah?
Yeah.
She was amazing.
Wow.
Linebacker. Detroit
right.
Lions.
Yes. Go team. but I imagine as a player, you have to just go all out, all or nothing on the field until it's done. And that's the same kind of attitude I have to have on stage. Just go all out. If you don't, then you're going to slip up.
Well, and the scary thing with comedy is you get that instant feedback as to whether or not what you're doing is working. So I've always compared it just to dramatic acting, which no one's supposed to laugh with dramatic acting. So when you're up there doing your thing, it gets to the end of the show and then you'll get the applause. And with comedy, though, you want to hear those laughs. If you don't hear them, you try not to let it affect you. Like, I try to listen to the laughter in my head because there's a lot in there.
That's great. I want to probe a little deeper into that self-talk. That I mean, any comedian, you already gave us your take on that and the mindset. How about you, Sarah? What is that self-talk when you're hearing a cricket and not the giggles that you want to hear to get you back in the moment? Because, I mean, I imagine what a battle it must be going on up there.
Well, it used to scare me and freak me out, and I would kind of tense up and I'd get really nervous. Now I just am like, okay, I just roll with it. And the way I've delivered has changed recently, actually. I used to try to just get up there and talk like I didn't think any of it was funny. And then if I got a laugh, that was extra exciting. It's like I would just keep talking and they never know what I intended to be funny. So when they laughed, it's like, that's what I meant. That's what I wanted you to laugh at. That other stuff, no. But now it's kind of changed a little bit. But if I don't get a laugh, I just can pause for a second and just keep going. And it doesn't bother me too much because every crowd is different.
Yeah.
I did the same, almost the exact same set within a week and a half of each other and two different places. And the responses were totally different with each bit that I did.
All within the triad?
Mm-hmm.
I got to see that whole thing, her go, because we just performed last night at Old Staley Steakhouse, and she was really physical, and a lot of stuff I do, I'll talk about something and then show you what I'm talking about, and Sarah was doing the same kind of physical stuff last night, and she used to just kind of stand there, and I was just like, wow, so I texted her last night, great job. I was like, I was proud.
But that just came, that evolution came naturally to you? What is it, more slapstick?
I just love physical comedy. I think it's a huge part, just with movies, when a character falls out of the frame, I love that every time. I love it. So I just love physical comedy. And I think you've got comics and you've got comedians. And this is one thing I've always talked about. Comics might say something in a funny way, but a comedian says funny things. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So I feel like I'm more of a comedic comic. So I'm more funny in the way I say things, or the way I, maybe what I do while I'm saying things. If I just get up there and say my material, it's not going to be as effective. So I have to include the physical and the voices and the accents or whatever that I do.
That's why it's so hard when someone asks you, tell me a joke. You can tell them something that you've written, but part of the energy that you get from those large crowds we like to be in front of helps you to perform it. You're writing for that moment. You're not writing to tell somebody at the mall.
Part one of my conversation with actor comedians J.J. Johnson and Sarah Barnhart. Comedy Potluck is Saturday, May 26th at 8 o'clock in the Community Arts Cafe Underground Theater on 4th Street in downtown Winston-Salem. The bi-monthly show, every second Tuesday and fourth Saturday of the month, features local stand-up comedians and Winston-Salem's own improv troupe, Naked Feet. You'll find links to more information and Sarah's sketch comedy website, The Dueling Butter Knives, at wfdd.org/triadarts. I'm David Ford, and this is Triad Arts Weekend. We'll hear the second half of my conversation with Sarah and JJ after the short little intermission, and we'll get to hear them strut their stuff. They're really funny and oh so quick on their feet.
You go in.
Say hello to Jim.
You grab a drink. You say hello to Jim Tedder, the owner.
Yes, fine.
You find yourself a nice seat near the front. Don't worry about sitting in the front. We like it when people sit close.
You won't single anybody out.
Not at all.
Never.
We're not those types of comedians.
It's really wonderful.
But we can't speak for the other comedians that'll be there.
Also in the second half of the show, you get front row seats for my guest, legendary trumpeter, longtime Seattle Symphony conductor, and current artistic director of the Eastern Music Festival, Maestro Gerard Schwartz. He'll make you want to scream encore! And we wrap up today with four of the world's finest early music performers live from Studio A. Where else? Next, when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Hey, welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and here's the second half of my interview with comedians Sarah Barnhart and J.J. Johnson. Tomorrow night, they'll be co-hosting Comedy Potluck, featuring local stand-up comedians and Winston-Salem's improv troupe, Naked Feet. That's tomorrow night at 8 in the Community Arts Cafe in downtown Winston-Salem. I began by asking Sarah about some of her shtick. Sarah, based on the video, you're not going to be getting any plastic surgery of any kind at any time. Tell me about false advertising. Could you? Here's your hand off.
All right, let's see. Give me a second.
Yeah.
I don't have exactly what people would call an hourglass figure. Nevertheless, you know, I'm 26. I'm still able to tell that time is running out, you know. And, you know, there are lots of things that ladies do to beef up their hourglass figures.
Huh.
And probably the cheapest least painful thing would be to buy a padded bra, but I'm not going to do that personally because that is what you call false advertising. What you see is what you get. It's the way it should be.
I appreciate that.
Or in my case, what you don't see is what you don't get.
Thank you. Should send that out to all the women across the world. And
I know.
No false advertising.
Right.
Are you down with that, JJ?
I'm down with that.
No false advertising.
Let's start a Facebook page. No false advertising. Like it.
In the event coming up, Comedy Potluck presentation at Community Arts Cafe.
Yes.
Set the scene for us. What's it like there on a Friday night?
You're going to go downtown. You're going to drive downtown. You're going to park somewhere near Spruce and 4th Street, the corner of Spruce and 4th. Then you're going to walk to the Community Arts Cafe, which is there on the corner. And you're going to go in that corner there at Commerce Plaza.
And then?
You just go down those stairs that are straight in front of you.
Yes.
You follow the chalkboard arrow to your left, and you go in the Underground Theater.
The Underground Theater. It's a theater that's underground.
Hence the name. And it's a very nice little venue.
I don't
think people realize that.
It is very nice.
Great acoustics. Nice Bose speakers.
Yeah.
They have a lot of really great events that go on there.
Yeah.
You pay $10. You go in.
Say hello to Jim.
You grab a drink. You say hello to Jim Tedder, the owner.
Yes.
Fine.
You find yourself a nice seat near the front. Don't worry about sitting in the front. We like it when people sit close.
You won't single anybody out.
Never.
We're not those types of comedians.
It's really wonderful.
But we can't speak for the other comedians that'll be there. JJ and I take turns hosting.
Yes.
The first portion of the show, which is stand-up comedy, and we get three local comics from the Triad. Actually, not just the Triad. We've had some from the outskirts of the Triad come in as well. Mm-hmm. And they each get about 10 minutes. And they make you laugh for a while. We take a short break. And then what happens, JJ?
Oh, after that, the feet, huh?
The feet.
We take a little break and we come back with Naked Feet.
Oh, my goodness. Well, this is appropriate for all ages?
I would say PG-13.
PG-13?
PG-13. And it's Winston's own improv troupe right here. And we make people laugh. And it's always different because it's improv.
It's like we do Whose Line Is It Anyway style. So we play a lot of games.
Yeah.
So every Comedy Potluck has stand-up and improv. It's about an hour and a half for $10, which is a good deal.
How often does it up your game? I mean, have you ever been in a situation, an improv dynamic, where how did I come up with that? That was really hilarious. Or no?
I don't know. I guess I've never really thought about that. But I do know it takes a lot of concentration and trust when you're up there with other actors. As someone that naturally wants to do stand-up comedy, as a stand-up comic, in the beginning, you would always want to go for the joke and improv, and you have to kind of learn to work with others and kind of play the straight role sometimes. And I think the whole improv thing just helps me with acting from a script when I do a role or something in a film or a show, whatever. That's when it gets to the point where I feel like the improv is helping me because of that training.
Actor comedians J.J. Johnson and Sarah Barnhart. Comedy Potluck is Saturday, May 26th at 8 o'clock in the Community Arts Cafe Underground Theater on 4th Street in downtown Winston-Salem. The bi-monthly show, every second Tuesday and fourth Saturday of the month, features local stand-up comedians and Winston-Salem's own improv troupe, Naked Feet. You'll find links to more information and Sarah's sketch comedy website, The Dueling Butter Knives, at wfdd.org/triadarts. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Coming up later this hour, tenor Glenn Siebert enchants us with his dulcet tones. Winston-Salem's own Seattle Baroque violinist Ingrid Matthews gives new meaning to Sheep Gut. And it's oboe like you've never heard it before with Deborah Nagy, plus the mighty, mysterious Theorbo in all its glory at the hands of gifted plucker and UNCSA alumnus John Lenti. They'll all be joining me in Studio A for a sneak peek at this year's Magnolia Baroque Festival offerings. So I hope you'll stick around for some truly inspiring performances coming up in just about 10 minutes. Speaking of festivals, it's just about that time of year for another of the Triad's finest fests to kick in gear. The Eastern Music Festival, under the direction of Gerard Schwartz, gets underway on June 23rd, and it'll continue with summer study for talented young artists and performances by world-renowned soloists through July 28th. Jerry was named music director of EMF back in 2007. Since then, he's expanded the festival's audiences to the largest in history while enhancing education and programming to include a composer in residence and three new concert series, including jazz, blues, and fringe, in addition to classical.
And it's in the world of classical music that Jerry has made his mark, first as principal trumpeter with the New York Philharmonic under the late, great Leonard Bernstein, and later on the podium himself while leading the Seattle Symphony to over a quarter century of amazing performances and a slew of award-winning recordings. He spoke with me from his studio in Seattle.
Could you compare the thrill of performing, say, the opening of a Mahler Fifth Symphony as a principal trumpeter versus the thrill of conducting that work?
Oh, wow. I don't know if there's anything as exciting as actually making the sound yourself. I did the Fifth Symphony of Mahler many times with Bernstein. We did it on tour quite a few times. I also did it with Leinsdorf. We did it on tour with Leinsdorf as well when I was in the New York Philharmonic. And to play that well, and I'm happy to say that I always played it well, was a thrill. It was so thrilling, the visceral excitement of the actual power, the feeling that it's close to perfect. You know, you'd finish a performance, if it went well, it wasn't like, oh, you have so much to learn. It was like, boy, this is how it goes. This is how it feels right. And it's there's nothing like that. As a conductor, you can be exhilarated, moved, touched in every possible way, but you know it can always be better. Always be better. If you're a great player, you can get to the point where, of course, artistically you'll always have growth and you'll always, but as an orchestral player, as a trumpet player in the orchestra, you can finish a concert and say, well, it can't be much better than that. And it's so exciting, especially with a Mahler symphony. As a conductor, the responsibilities are much greater. You're not making the sound yourself. You don't have that excitement of making the sound. But a lot else relies on you. When they rely on you, then you know, it's a wonderful experience, but it's not the same, and you're not making the sound. There's something about making that sound that's so special.
My thanks to Eastern Music Festival music director Gerard Schwartz. He spoke with me from his studio in Seattle, Washington. EMF 2012 gets underway June 23rd, and it'll continue with summer study for talented young artists and performances by world-renowned soloists through July 28th. I'm David Ford, and are you ready to rock Baroque style? I sure hope so. Here they are now, live from Studio A, Magnolia Baroque Festival musicians, tenor Glenn Siebert, violinist Ingrid Matthews, oboist Deborah Nagy, and theorbo and lute player John Lenti. the Chaconne in C by Lully. But when you finish a piece like that, what's the feeling like? I'm going to throw it your way, John. I've never seen the theorbo in action live like that. It's a very physical instrument. You're really invested in it. I mean, it was fun to watch and hear.
Oh, well, it's a lot of fun to play. I have a background in guitar, and you know, you get accustomed to playing on smaller, you know, well, instruments that don't have like 10 inches worth of bridge to play. And so, you know, you get to cover a lot of real estate. And in something like this, where I'm the only bass line instrument, usually I'm sharing that duty with a harpsichord and a cello and other things. In this case, I get to play all these notes and, you know, figure out as best I can inventive ways of making it a satisfying musical texture. So it's, well, you said when we get to the end, how do we feel? Part of it is, whew, I managed to play most of the notes without a cello to help. But also it's great fun to be the one sort of holding it down, you know, to feel like I get to support the two melodic instruments.
Would you describe the dimensions of this? That's an amazing instrument just to look at. We're talking about a theorbo here.
Theorbo, yeah. The instrument is about 5 feet long. It's held in the lap like a guitar. It's got two ranks of strings. I've got short strings that are tuned in intervals kind of similar to a guitar or a lute. It's different, but more or less the same idea. I fret them, and I strum, and I pluck, just like I would, you know, whatever other instrument. And then it's got a second rank of strings that are twice as long as those, and they're tuned in a scale, so it's like I have the bass range of a harp tacked on to my lute. And that's actually exactly what they did initially. The earliest theorbos were conversion jobs. Like, they took a big lute. The lute usually has that neck that bends back. And they sawed that off, and they glued on an extension with extra strings. And so what I have is an instrument with, you know, a wonderful, rich bass range. And the harmony. So, like, I don't have to fret those low strings. They're just tuned in a scale. So I only, you know, I just play them with the thumb of my right hand, and that frees up my fingers and my right hand and then the left hand to make the harmony up above.
You've got a lute on steroids.
Lute on steroids, yeah. Or a lute and a garden rake that had a baby. You know, like, there are a lot of different things that people compare it to.
I'm looking over your shoulder here looking at the music. I mean, this is like a sometimes jazz piano player at home where we have the real book and just a chord symbol and maybe a melody. That's what you're working on here. I'm hearing all these amazing sounds, and I know you're not winging it. It's all based on a system and a tradition, but talk about what you've got before you and how you're turning that into these glorious kind of symphonic sounds.
Okay, well, what I have in front of me is just a bass line. It's just a single melodic line, and what I have written above some of the notes of the bass line are numbers. The numbers, we call them figures, and what they do is they indicate what the harmony is supposed to be. You work to a certain extent according to the key signature of the piece. Like, if I don't have anything written, then I just play kind of what makes sense. So it's a very freeing kind of notation just to have these figural suggestions above the bass line.
I want to get in some of the freedom then from a melodic sense too, Deborah, because I'm hearing just through the ornamentation and the nuance of what you're doing with Ingrid, that freedom, but I don't know how much of that is in an improvisatory sense or how much of it's written in from a melodic perspective.
Well, I think there is a lot of freedom. I hesitate to say improvisation, though there is some of that as well. Part of the freedom is rhythmic freedom. So, I mean, you're looking over my shoulder as well. My page is full of quarter notes and eighth notes. That doesn't really amount to very much interest-wise. But the French had a tradition of playing their eighth notes unequally, and there was a great flexibility. When I look at the page, I look at, you know, these quarter notes and eighth notes and maybe dotted quarter notes, and those tell me less about how I should play those individual notes so much as where the next note comes and what I might fit in between.
So you might see, for the non-musician out there listening, you might see a group of eighth notes, which traditionally would just be da 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 da. But in a French sense, oftentimes that might be more lilting. Or give me an example of that.
It could be da da ti da ta da ta, which had hopefully five or six different qualities of eighth note in that bar of eighth notes that you just sang.
And how do you get on the same page with Ingrid? Because you're playing a lot of these lines together, and how do you know that she's going to be taking that on the same way you are?
I mean, we come from a kind of a common knowledge base in terms of performance practice, but we're also good chamber musicians, and we're listening and responding and, you know, on the fly.
Well, I was really enjoying not only hearing you all play with, but the movement. I think seeing and hearing you all perform together, it's so worthwhile because it somehow contemporizes it. I mean, there's this dance-like sense, there's this drive, there's this energy that I'm picking up on, and you're actually moving together many of the times. Ingrid, talk about the bringing out the dance in this Chaconne.
Well, I think bringing out the dance has a lot to do with what Deborah was talking about with the rhythm. That a chaconne is, you could say it's two things. It's a repetitive harmonic pattern, as John mentioned. It's based on four descending chords that repeat over and over. So that's one thing, but it's also a dance, and it needs to feel like a dance. And if we played all of the eighth notes and quarter notes very straight, it might not feel like a dance. So what Deborah's talking about, and you asked sort of how we decide or how we know exactly how we're going to vary the rhythm and put our slightly unequal spin on the eighth notes. It's all sort of organized around the strong downbeats, and the result of that is that it feels more dance-like.
Well, I want to talk about your instrument and your instrument, but let's hear some more music first. I feel like a kid in a candy store. What's next on the program? We're hearing something from Caccini.
Yeah, Giulio Caccini was a singer-composer who really helped develop opera, and he had a style of singing as well that had a lot of freedom, just like the Lully. And he called it sprezzatura, and that was a kind of casualness of rhythm that you were to bring to the music.
Sprezzatura.
Sprezzatura.
Sprezzatura. And last year it was trillo. We always get a new word out of you.
You know, I'll do a trillo for you too.
Will you do a trillo? Just for me. This is a dedicated trillo. Yeah. And I should say, this is Glenn Siebert, fine tenor and founder director of Magnolia Baroque Festival. Here is... What's the title of this ditty?
Amarilli mia bella. Amaryllis, my sweetie.
Live from Studio A. Glenn Siebert. He'll be accompanied on the Theorbo by John Lenti.
Amarilli mia bella, non credi o del mio dor, dolce desio, d'esser tu. Amore mio, credilo pur, e se ti morta sale, tu vitar non ti vale. Hai scritto in cuore, amarilli, 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 è il mio amore.
Amarilli mia bella, something like that.
Yes.
Yeah. Hey, it sounded great.
Thanks.
Glenn Siebert performing tenor and John Lenti, theorbo player. We got our trillo or two or three. Oh, they were awesome. See, we got to have an isolate. When I say trillo, it's not a trill. It's not a vibrato. It's something extra, something
sounds
different.
Like a, sounds like a goat.
Yeah. Give me a trillo. Let's isolate that trillo.
Yeah. Not so great, but
is it okay, Trilo? We'll give that a 4 or 5. So you
out of 10.
So I didn't give you the upscale on that one. And what do we know about Caccini?
Caccini, Italian singer, is from Rome, but worked in Florence and was involved with the first creation of opera. And this type of music is a new type of music that was being developed. It was monophonic, had what John was talking about, just that single bass line, and everything above the bass line, you were able to articulate the texts better. And that's really how opera developed, out of that bass line, supporting a harmony without it being written out, and being able to really express text above that bass line without polyphonic texture getting in the way.
Polyphonic, lots of voices, lots of stuff, lots of notes going on. And Deborah, I was struck by the warmth of this sound. I mean, it really is a warm, almost oboe d'amore kind of sound. Is it, how much of that is your great playing? How much of the instrument itself? Talk about this instrument.
The sound of the Baroque oboe is really quite different, and that actually, it's part of its kind of aesthetic conception. The oboe that I'm playing was essentially invented at the court of Louis XIV in the 1660s and 70s. And just as Glenn was talking about the kind of important development of monody with the Caccini that he sang, that you have a text that you're able to put forth and it's not sort of sullied by all these polyphonic, you know, all these other parts or voices. That was the trend in instrumental music as well. And that was also definitely a trend for wind playing. So before the Baroque era, there was also an oboe, but it was very loud, and it was usually played in a polyphonic setting, usually outside. And what they did at the court of Louis XIV was really kind of tame and civilize that instrument. The pitch got lowered considerably, and part of the low pitch is part of the kind of mellowness that you're responding to. But you're right, it's mellow and quite sweet.
Give me an excerpt that you particularly love, that maybe a short section from an aria or something, an obbligato part that would highlight that.
I'll play the opening from the Sinfonia that goes to Cantata 12 that we're doing next week on the concert.
Great. This is a Bach cantata, and Bach, an early cantata when he was just trying to prove himself in the world. Thanks, Deborah. We'll hear from Ingrid Matthews. I wonder if you could talk through, from the performance end, how your instrument, your bow, enables you to more fully embrace the traditions in terms of either ornamentation or just some of the neat things that you can do that are really tough on a modern instrument, the modern bow.
Okay, well, my violin is from 1703, and it's kind of a special instrument because it's in its original condition. There are a lot of violins out there that survive from that time, but most of them have had surgery over the centuries to make them louder and brighter and more appropriate for big modern concert halls and the higher pitch. My violin has its original neck, so it's quite rare. That probably means that throughout the 19th century, it probably wasn't being played very much, or not by a professional, because if it had been, it would have been altered.
And does that translate into a shorter neck?
It might be a tiny bit shorter, but it's set at a different angle. It's kind of hard to describe on the radio, but it's set at an angle that puts the strings under less tension. So therefore, the fingerboard, which I put my fingers on, is lower, the bridge is lower, so there's less tension overall, and that accounts for a mellower sound than a modern violin has. Also, there are some structural differences on the inside that you can't see with the bass bar and things like this. And the strings are made of sheep gut, unwound sheep gut I'm using on my upper strings.
And this is not synthetic unwound sheep gut. This is the real deal.
No, it's not a vegetarian, shall we say.
It's not a vegan violin.
No, I'm afraid not. But at least it's not cat gut, right?
As a cat owner, yes, I should say so. What, how about just a sample? Let's hear just a short excerpt. Just to show off that, as you say, that beautiful, personal, mellow sound. I can't describe it, and I won't even try to. We'll just hear some. Thank you. Oh, that is so beautiful. Thank you so much. Ingrid Matthews performing violin and John Lenti performing the oboe for us. And thank you very much. Glenn Siebert, tenor, Deborah Nagy, oboist. And thank all of you for coming and playing for us. That was really fun. Magnolia Baroque Festival begins tonight at 7:30 in Watson Hall on the University of North Carolina School of the Arts campus with a concert titled Divas. The brilliant violinist from whom we just heard, Ingrid Matthews, will be joined by yet another leading Baroque violinist, Julie Andrzejewski, performing music for solo violin and continuo. Magnolia Baroque continues with amazing performances through Thursday, May 31st, and you'll find links to more information and podcasts of this program on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. You'll also find some neat pictures of the Magnolia Baroque Band playing live in Studio A, where you can get a glimpse of that lute on steroids, the mighty Theorbo. Wow, that was quite an artistic journey today, and I'm so glad you were able to join me. I sure had a lot of fun, and I hope you did too. That journey continues next week on Triad Arts Up Close, where on Monday I'll dive headfirst, and very gladly I might add, into the art of gelato making. Cafe Gelato owner Siska Weber will walk me through the ages-old craft, and I'll be forced to sample the delicious flavors from fresh mango and cantaloupe to Nutella and pistachio. Don't worry, I'll save you a spoonful. Also coming up next week, it's Sika's Design Marathon and the Claire Culbreth Band, Shades of Blue, live from Studio A. In the meantime, I'd love to hear from you. Please send your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.